Group meeting, Sunday, 3rd July 1983. If you wish to travel to any place, you must first know where it is, and you must know what it is. Is it a house or a city, a continent or a mountain range or whatever it may be? Next, you have to know how to get there, whether by train or by plane, or whether you have to climb or walk or whatever your method of getting there may be. Then again, you have to be able to recognize it when you get there, from descriptions which are written or which you have heard of, or from pictures and so on. If you want to start a business, you must have capital. It will need perhaps a factory or a shop. You may need partners. You will certainly need staff, employees, and the right locality. I don't suppose you'd start manufacturing ships in your flower garden or buses on the sea beach. What all this amounts to is that you have a known goal, equipment, technical skill, and so on. But all this belongs to the world of the known. Now, to play a game with a partner, another person who will play, you have to know the rules of the game and the technique of the game, and you have to develop the skill, and so on and so on. But when we are concerned with religious living, everything is totally different. It is really totally different. The mass of the people in the world, in attempting to live the religious life, try to do so in the terms which they are already acquainted with it. They have a goal, they have equipment, they have the means, they have a way laid down, they have methods, they have skills which they have to acquire, and so on. Now the question arises, can you know your goal? If you want to start a business, you know what you want to do. It's something known. You have made the necessary preparations, you have the necessary capital, or you borrow it from the bank, or whatever is the procedure. But in the case of religious living, can you know your goal? We can arbitrarily assert, that the goal is God or transcendence or Brahman or Atma or moksha, liberation, or nirvana, and so on. Of course, those who say that their goal is nirvana are really using the wrong word, because the literal meaning of nirvana is the extinction of all greed, hate, and delusion. That is the means by which the summum bonum, the ultimate beatific state is realized, which is quite different from saying that nirvana is the goal. But because nirvana, the means, is associated with the inevitable consequential experience of that beatific condition, therefore people talk, not too inaccurately, but we all know what they mean, when they say the goal is nirvana. Or Christians call it the kingdom of heaven. The Zarathustrians call it garodhimana, and so on. See, we may arbitrarily give such names, but can we use any equipment for it? The organized religions of the world will say, oh yes, there is a technique The whole procedure of organized religion, prayer, congregational worship, or private worship, and so on. All that, so the church, the temple, the mosque, becomes the equipment for religious living. Now we have seen in the history of man, throughout at least 30 or 40 centuries, what has happened as far as using this equipment is concerned. It need not be denied that there is a certain elevation of mood, a certain experience of that which is sublime and which brings a certain amount of peace and an indescribable satisfaction to the psyche through the ceremonial procedure, through the ritual. One believes in the power of the ritual to transform one's being and make him fit to be with the Supreme after death, whatever the Supreme may be. Then, of course, there is the question of developing a technique, and this technique involves the what are commonly called the religious observances, the niyamas in the Upanishads and in Patanjali's yoga, the yamas, the postures, breathing, and all the rest which belongs to yoga, and of course the techniques of meditation. The strange part of the story is that the real meaning of meditation, samadhi, to use the Indian word, the real meaning of samadhi is not at all understood, not properly understood. It is translated as concentration. One is taught, turn your attention to this, hold this in your mind, and think about it, or muse on that subject. Now this is by no means meditation in the real sense. It's not samadhi, sang adi, the supreme togetherness. And it must be borne in mind that in the supreme togetherness, all sense of separate selfhood has completely vanished. That is the real supreme togetherness. All sense, all awareness of the psychophysical organism as the observing or experiencing subject is completely out.
Sorry to be a little late.
And if all sense of separate selfhood is out, then in that realization there is only the reality of the Supreme, whatever that may be. The Absolute alone is the ultimate real. And it is indescribable, inconceivable. It has no characteristics. That is to say, we human beings have a tendency to give characteristics to the Supreme, whatever that Supreme may be. But that Supreme state is without any characteristics. Both in the Upanishads and in the teachings of the Buddha, it has been clearly shown that there are no characteristics. Theistic religions have suggested phrases like this: God is love. Others have spoken of God is truth. In our own day and age, Gandhi was a very great supporter of that statement. God is the truth, and so forth. And there may be several others who support that statement. But what does that statement mean to me as an ordinary human being? Because I give the definition of truth. I say to be truthful means to think and speak and behave in accordance with the actuality present. But that assumes that I have this extraordinary ability to see the whole of that actuality present. And I, the ordinary man, simply do not possess that power. It is only what we call the perfected Holy One who is able to have that sort of perception, that sort of understanding and vision. So, you see, we have to be very, very sensitive to the fact that the Supreme is indescribable, altogether indescribable. The moment we describe it and then try to live in such a manner as to fulfill that description, we have gone astray. It's no longer religious living. It is human living, if you like, yes, and human in the true and deep sense of the word. But it is not religious living. Because the context of religion is not this which we are aware of, the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. The context of religion is the transcendent context of the infinite, eternal, immortal. Now, putting it that way, one may think, oh, that is the other world, completely different, completely distant from us. Now that also is not true. The extraordinary fact is that this transcendent context of the infinite, eternal and immortal completely subsumes and completely interpenetrates the whole of the finite and the temporal and the mortal world. If you realize that state of awareness which we call immortality, you will discover that immortality rides on the wings of time, and time belongs to the sphere of mortality. This is an extraordinary thing. But this is the sort of thing to which we must awake. If we can take the right sort of steps which truly represent religious living. So now, to come back to this statement about meditation and samadhi as the supreme togetherness, in which all sense of separate selfhood is completely gone. You are, so to say, you know, most scholars, Western scholars particularly, have talked of it in terms of lost in the Absolute, lost in Brahman. And of course, we being naturally inveterate egoists, we cling so hard to the ego that we just will not accept any such possibility for us. And yet, if we can be free of the limitations imposed on us by our self-esteem, our conceit, our clinging to ego, this terrible clinging to the ego as such, if we can be free of that, then we will realize that what we understand as ourselves, what I understand as myself, is just an association with the whole of the psychophysical organism. It's an association with that organism and or with any one or more constituents of that organism. The body, the feelings, the intellect, and so on. You see? Now all these elements are perishable. When the body dies, the whole of the psyche goes with it. There is no such thing as my mind. There is definitely a thing like my psyche, as definitely as there is my liver or heart or my nose. Because psyche is a word which really represents the mental, emotional activity of the living psychophysical organism. And that activity is not only psychical by nature, but it also is physical by nature. The electrochemistry of the whole body comes into play with every single thought, feeling, mood, and so on. But all this is the perishable, completely perishable. Now, the imperishable, the transcendent, the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal, not only subsumes this, contains it, you see, but also completely interpenetrates it. First, let us understand the nature of the containment. The containment is not like a box containing so many different objects or articles. It is a containment in which the box, so to say, is that which it contains. You have a box containing 100 oranges, we'll say. But if you can sort of imagine, and it's almost impossible to imagine, that wooden box is those 100 oranges, and the 100 oranges are the box, and yet they can be separated as particular objects, particular individuals, if you like, you see. That is the nature of the containment. We say space contains us. The whole cosmos is contained in space. But the fact is that space is the whole cosmos. And the whole cosmos is space. You see, these are words which are troublesome, if you like. to be aware of such things is quite different from making cut and dried concepts about it. Cut and dried concepts about anything prevent sensitivity to the actuality as the whole actuality. So now, back to the meaning of meditation and samadhi. Perhaps I'll come back to the other point in this connection. That the transcendent context, the infinite and the eternal, completely interpenetrates every single particular of which we are aware. You see, we talk of different particulars. We talk of objects, small objects, large objects, people, creatures, trees, planets, suns, galaxies, and so on. But you see, we are conscious of the cosmos in that limited manner, which makes us talk of the cosmos in separative terms. We are unable, as ordinary human beings, or even as perfected holy ones, to be totally conscious of the unitary wholeness of the totality. We are not. We talk like this because, perforce, we are restricted by our constitution. We are so constituted that we have no option in the matter but to talk like this. So now, the whole of the transcendent context is totally embodied in each and every single particular of which we are aware, or which we postulate: a galaxy, a solar system, the stars, you, I, family, and so on. Whatever we postulate, the whole of eternity, the whole of infinity is totally present in there. Not just a bit of eternity or a bit of infinity is present anywhere. Because if you try and sense infinity, you will see you can't split up infinity. You can't split it up. You may remember some months ago, I put it this way, that you can't cut off a slab of space and screw your nameplate upon it. You can screw your nameplate upon your front gate or whatever it is, but you can't cut off a bit of space and screw your nameplate upon it. So you see, infinity being of that nature, and eternity similarly being of that nature, don't associate it with time or timelessness. That is to say, don't restrict it to time or timelessness. Eternity is that which completely subsumes and interpenetrates time, space, everything. I'm using two different words for a very simple reason. We, as we are constituted, are spatially conscious, and we are temporally conscious. We are conscious of distance, we are conscious of time. And in time and in distance and in time, there is movement and all the activity of which we are aware. You see? But if you take these words and let the brain be as quiet as possible and try and sense this transcendence, you will find some extraordinary things happening. You see, here and there completely disappear. forwards, backwards, completely disappear. Infinity is infinity. There is no here, there, forwards, backwards, up, down, sideways, anything. But you see, we can't be conscious, really conscious in that manner. If we could, we would be God. Now you see, I am ascribing this to God. You see how difficult it is to talk. Don't believe a word of what I say. Consider it quietly. When you are quiet, don't say, I must now just be quiet for 20 minutes and consider this. You'll get nowhere at all. You'll only suffer from a tremendous turmoil in the brain. But when the right condition presents itself, you will find that you'll be helped by, in a mysterious way, by the invisible environment. And then you will be able to sense something of it. So you see, eternity and infinity are totally, because they cannot be split up, totally, they totally interpenetrate every single particular of which we are aware. I have to speak in that way simply because I, as an ordinary human being, am aware normally in terms of separateness, in terms of isolativeness. I, the subject, I, Firoz Mehta, who is not John Brown or anybody else, you see, cannot avoid speaking in that way and being conscious in that way. But the words, if you just let them work by themselves in you, might bring about, help be in the emergence of a dormant sensitivity right within your whole being. And then mind, in its supreme sense, it is a universal cosmic energy. That is what mind is. Characterless, actually. I don't possess mind. I do have psyche, psyche comes into being because this universal energy mind, interacting with corporeality, with body, gives rise to psyche. You see, psyche is specific. It is different for every single human being. Every single psychophysical organism is unique. There is no one else like you. Never was, not is, never will be. That is the nature of the evolutionary process as we see it working through the entire material universe. So, when this meditative state really is present, the true samadhi is present, this isolative, self-oriented self-consciousness has completely vanished. And during that period that you can experience that state, you do experience it during a period only, you are experiencing timelessness, not eternity as yet. For the very simple reason that timeless, the experiencing of timelessness is held within the bounds of time. There's a moment of time when you enter that. There's a moment of time when you emerge out of that. You see? So, when we say, you know, was it Rom Landau who wrote a book entitled God is My Adventure?
Yes.
Rom Landau. It's a very interesting book, and books of that nature have been written. But you see, all that talk, like my talk, is mostly verbiage. But if my verbiage happens to spark off something in your inner nature, which arouses that dormant sensitivity to transcendence, then my verbiage is prophetic speech. That is the meaning of prophecy. The speech which will arouse the sensitivity to transcendence in the listener. It's the sensitivity to the indescribable. So you see, religious living means living in tune with that sensitivity. Let that sensitivity operate, and then religious living in the true sense can come into being. It is true that the preparatory work for the psychophysical organism can be spoken of in terms of the moralities, in terms of aspiration, in terms of fulfilling one's duties in life and so forth, and actually being the instrument of transcendence for spreading right relationship everywhere between oneself and what we commonly call the not-self, everybody else. So that is the preparatory work only. But don't imagine that with every little flash of inspiration or every little success in having a conscious experience of that which is beyond one, you are there. You never are there. You are always here. There is no future at all. The whole of the future is an activity of anticipation by the psyche. The reality, the actuality, is the immediate moment, the unsplittable moment, the moment that is so small that it is as small as what modern astrophysicists talk of as the singularity, which burst open and lo and behold the cosmos came into being. People also talk of the goal as achieving or attaining Buddhahood or Christhood or sainthood or anything like that. The self-conscious, isolatively self-conscious subject can never achieve or attain anything like that. It is transcendence at work which manifests through the person who lives in such a manner that his whole organic being offers no resistance to transcendence. And then the phenomenon takes place. If you look at the lives of all the founders of the great religions, take Zarathustra, Krishna, the Buddha, or any one of them, you see, you will find that they never achieved or attained anything. They had so purified themselves, they had so emptied themselves, that transcendence worked freely. You see, we human beings are like a fog. the light of the sun cannot come through. Clouds, thick, heavy clouds all the time. If the clouds are removed, if the fog disappears, then the light of the sun is present. It is present all the time, but the fog prevents it. And all our psychophysical processes and activities tend to prevent the light of transcendence from coming through. So this is what we have to work upon, and not try to fix any particular goal. Take another look at this situation. Can you play the game of life, the of religious living particularly, with transcendence? Can you play the game? Here, when we say play the game, it always implies somebody with whom you play. Unfortunately, in very modern times, play has become a fight, not a play. And we always talk of playing against. Haven't you noticed? One cricket team plays against another cricket team. Do we ever talk in terms of playing with the Australians or West Indies or anybody else? To play with is a cooperative activity. It is a harmonizing activity. Playing against is a conflict. The loser is miserable. The victor is elated. His ego balloons. Isn't that the fact? So now, when you play, if you wish to play the game of life with transcendence, you are up against an insoluble problem. In the world, we play a game with an other, don't we? Whatever or whoever that other may be. But if we think in terms of playing the game of life with transcendence, we are trying to make transcendence an other, which is an absolute impossibility, because that which is the infinite and the eternal is everything altogether. Is me. I am the separative, self-conscious player. How shall I play with transcendence? Can I see transcendence? Can I touch transcendence? Can I imagine transcendence? I can't. You see, it is so important, it is really so important for religious living to begin to be sensitive to these things, because thereby we are what in Christian mysticism was called reduced to our own nothingness, no thingness. When we are reduced to our no thingness, we have emerged into our all spirit, which is the totality. And therefore there is no conceit. There is humility of the real sort. We really have proved in actual fact, not only to ourselves, but in actual fact, that we are as no thing, nothing. So, if we still like to talk in terms of playing the game with God or with transcendence, transcendence or God is the unknowable. simply because we can know, not with our brains, but with our deep inner consciousness, we can know only to the extent that the structure, the constitution of the psychophysical organism will allow us to know. We must acknowledge that our limitation. If we don't acknowledge our limitation, and are all our limitations, there is no possibility of living the religious life in the full sense. The ways of transcendence are inscrutable. We are very, very curious altogether. One day we may talk more about that. Now, you may say, the holy ones declared this, that and the other as the goal and gave us advices, they showed ways to reach that goal and so forth. All those are human goals and human achievements and attainments belonging to the sphere of mortality, of death. This, in a sense, wipes out, so to say, discards that which has come down as what we not unreasonably regard as our most priceless heritage. The deep religious teachings of the world during the last 6,000 years. But now look at it this way. I said that the whole of transcendence is embodied in each of us, the particulars. Not a bit of transcendence. That is why I refuse to say my soul, my God, my this, that or the other. You cannot possess transcendence. You cannot possess the infinite, the eternal. It possesses you, if possession there is in any sense at all. And I don't know what it is. You see? All right. But since it is embodied in us, in this living organism, in every case, in every single case throughout the entire cosmos, every single thing is unique. And the way is through our own uniqueness as embodied in our own organism. The body is your best teacher. If you study the body and its workings, look at the way it cooperates. All the different parts of the body cooperate with each other. Look how when one part is injured, the whole of the body comes to its assistance. Do we do that as a human race? Oh yes, we do give £10, £1,000 in charity to some people who have suffered from an earthquake and so on. But do the 4,000 millions run towards you when you are ill or hurt? They don't. Of course, obviously, because they cannot. And it would be rather an overwhelming help. It would probably kill us off altogether. But you understand what I'm trying to present. You see? All right. So, playing the game with transcendence is not to win against transcendence, but to give yourself unconditionally, unreservedly, totally to transcendence. When I am not, transcendence is fully manifest through what I call me. And this is religious living in the supreme sense, as far as I can see. Thank you.